welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author joining us from Grove City College is Paul Kengor, PhD. His book, The Stigmatists, Their Gifts, Their Revelations, Their Warnings, published by TAN, available naturally through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Always great to have you on the program, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
It's always great to be on this show, Doug. Thank you very much.
And of course, people would have seen you on with Father Mitch, talking about this same topic as well. I'm interested, you know, Ronald Reagan to Karl Marx to stigmatists. I almost understand the first two connection. I'm not sure how did you get to this topic.
Yeah, that's a good question. But, you know, for me, I've always been fascinated by stigmatists. So I'm a convert to the faith. I mean, actually, I'm technically a revert. Mm-hmm. But when I was an evangelical in the 1990s, when I really kind of feel like I first became a Christian, I was just intrigued by stigmatists. I mean, I saw pictures of Padre Pio. I saw a video. I knew that Padre Pio was fairly contemporary. So he died in 1968. I was born in 1966, so he's in my lifetime. He's in the lifetime of many Catholics. And I had read a biography of Padre Pio at one point. And in fact, the one that's written by C. Bernard Ruffin, who's a Lutheran pastor.
Right, I interviewed him, yes, a couple of times. I remember him.
He's very interesting. And he's since done an updated edition of it. He has not converted to Catholicism, so he remains a Protestant. And I read the different accounts of Pio Stigmata. And since then, I've read, I mean, on Pio alone, probably dozens of books. Monsignor Cardi was one author, Monsignor Rossi, Ignatius Press, I think, published that book. It's about the report that was done in the early 1920s by the Vatican on Padre Pio Stigmata. And you read these, and it's just clear that they're real. Mm-hmm. I mean, right? I mean, they're not. It's not being fake.
Is that the attraction for you, for you to be able to see contemporaneously that these things are real, not just, gee, St. Francis of Assisi supposedly had this way back when?
Yeah, because I mean, I'm like the Apostle Thomas, right? I mean, you know, I need to walk up to the Lord Jesus, and if I could put my fingers in the palm, the holes in the palms of his hands, right? I come from a science background. I've always been skeptical. I'm somebody that, you know, I wish I could believe on faith more than anything else. But for me, it helps to see miracles and things that are supernatural. And with somebody like Francis, St. Francis, so we just marked not long ago the 800th anniversary of him receiving the stigmata. So that was September 17th, 1224. So, you know, a lot of people, Doug, could say, well, I mean, come on, that's, you know, that's 800 years ago. I mean, to quote Vladimir Lenin, right? That's medieval mildew, right? Superstition. Where's the evidence? Where are the pictures, right? I know we have some, we have some paintings and we have some claims from contemporaries, but I want to see video. I want to see pictures. Well, we have videos and pictures of Padre Pio and a whole bunch of others. In fact, I have seven specific chapters in the book where I profile individual stigmatists. Right. And several of them were lived into the 1900s. Gemma Galgani died in 1903. A little nun named Sister Elena Aiello, she's a blessed. That's the longest chapter
I never heard
of
her. She was new to me.
She's a new one. Therese Newman died in the early 1960s. Elena Aiello died in 1961. So we have a bunch of them now that have lived into the 20th century, and you could look them up online. Now, there's always the problem of, you know, doctored photos and fake stuff today, especially on the internet.
You really looked into that to see what was real and what wasn't, especially as you allude to even dealing with Wikipedia, which you can't trust either.
Right. Yeah. And in many cases, so a lot of this, Doug, was I did a lot of this is my own sort of investigation, curiosity, right? I have a lot of books on Pio. I have a lot of books on Catherine of Siena. She's on the cover of the book. She's one of my favorites. She had hidden stigmata. I'm a Francis fan, right? I have a special devotion to Francis. I actually have a replica at our house of the San Damiano cross that hangs on our wall. And all these people happen to be stigmatists. Mm-hmm. And then I would read online with some different websites, you know, some that aren't, you know, you don't feel they're fully trustworthy, right? Mm-hmm. Claims about this particular person having these prophecies, these visions, those visions. And then you find out, wow, that person was a stigmatist too. So in the case of someone like Elena Aiello, I thought, wow, did this little nun from Calabria, which is where my family's from, you wouldn't know from my Polish last name, but my mother is 100% Italian, she's from Calabria. And I thought, she really had these prophecies? Mm-hmm. She was really bleeding like this, and she died in 1961. Give me the books. Give me the books. So I got whatever books that I could, collected things, researched on my own, went to archives at the University of Dayton in Cincinnati, and confirmed different first-person accounts. So a lot of it, I started off by, as a scholar, doing my own investigation, writing these things, putting, oh, this could be an article. Wow, it's going to be a long article. It's going to be 40 pages. Where am I going to publish that, right? Mm. Well, that could be a chapter in a book. That too, that could be. So I started getting this book, this box of stuff, and pretty soon I thought, I need to write this just not for my own curiosity, but for everybody else to know about as well.
Well, as you said there, you alluded to it there, you said that there's been very few books that take a serious, reliable, careful look at stigmatists, specifically one might call visionary stigmatists. And then you say, are there any other kind of stigmatists? There aren't. Visionary is always part of it, at least in your research.
That's what I've seen. Yeah. In fact, I mean, there are so many examples of that, Doug. Take something like the 3 days of darkness prophecy, right? In fact, speaking of Wikipedia, if you type in 3 days of darkness into Wikipedia, they quote Blessed Anna Maria Taigi, who lived about roughly 1769, 1837, something like that. Born in Siena, like Catherine of Siena, mother of seven, died in Rome, and she's associated with the 3 days of darkness prophecy. Mm-hmm. Now, someone else who's associated with that, Marie Julie Jehenny, and she supposedly had the stigmata for like 50, 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. She's not a church-recognized saint, so I didn't have a full chapter on her. She's associated with 3 days of darkness, beeswax, candles, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Saint Faustina Kowalska, the first canonized saint of the new millennium, born 1905, died 1938. She's the Divine Mercy Saint. Because of her, we have the Divine Mercy Chaplet. The Lord told her, you will prepare the world for my second coming. Mm-hmm. She had visions of days of darkness, final chastisement, end times. And guess what? People don't realize this, but go back and read the diary carefully. She had stigmata. Elena Aiello, same thing. So in so many cases, Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich, they had some of the most remarkable visionaries in the church just happened to be stigmatists.
Right. It's interesting. And you have a whole chapter about prophetic warnings at the end because related to these kind of visions and some of the other people and saints attached to that. You also say this book gives special attention to church-approved stigmatists. Are there unapproved stigmatists out there that you looked into?
So there's a list. I tried to get a list, Doug, of how many stigmatists there have been, right? Mm-hmm. And to my knowledge, the Vatican doesn't keep a running list. They don't investigate every claim. There was a French doctor who did a book in 1894. And at that point, he came up with a list of about 300. And by the way, he found every single case was Catholic, Roman Catholic. Now, there have been a couple studies since. I cite them in the book.
Right, you do.
And and different academic institutions that have tried to do this, one in Belgium. And it looks like in the course of history, there have been about 400 to 500 stigmatists. Now, I wish there was a church-approved list. To my knowledge, there's not. But about 400 to 500 altogether. Now, very interesting, especially given that the most famous stigmatists are men, St. Francis being the first.
I was going to go there, ask you about that, right.
Yeah, Padre Pio, and probably the first stigmatist was probably St. Paul. in the Bible. Now, you know, but he says in Galatians, I bear in my body the marks, the stigmata in Greek, of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And in fact, two of the visionary stigmatists, Anne Catherine Emmerich and Therese Newman, who could see things in the past as well as in the future, both told their spiritual directors, hey, I saw Francis. He had the stigmata. But guess what? I also saw St. Paul, and he was the first. He was the first. So could he have had
they're saying that, but he could also have had what you referred to earlier as the hidden stigmata, right?
He could, but they said they actually saw physically it, right. You have visible stigmata. So the first three could have been, right, St. Paul, St. Francis, and then the most famous one, Padre Pio. Mm-hmm. However, of the 400 to 500 that have been out there in history, over 90% have been women.
Right. Also, Italian, right? Isn't a high percentage Italian?
That's right. About 70% have been Italian. So really, kind of the most common profile would be an Italian woman. Now, that also is reflection of the fact that more saints have come from Italy than any other country. Second would be France. And then I think third for number of stigmatists would be Germany. Now, today, and you could probably say this is consistent with Pope Francis's statement about the periphery of the church, right? How the church is growing in Asia, Africa, outside of Europe. Hilaire Belloc once said, the faith is Europe and Europe is the faith. Well, the faith has been declining in Europe, and we're now seeing more and more stigmatists from outside of Europe, outside of Italy and France. We're seeing them in Asia, we're seeing them in Africa. And there appear to be more in modern times than ever before. And I know some people might say, well, I mean, come on, there might have been a bunch of them in the year 800, we just don't know about it. I wouldn't say that, because when these people, after Francis, after Catherine of Siena, when they bear the marks of Jesus in their hands and side and feet, and they're bleeding, or crown of thorns, or St. Rita of Cassia around the year 1500 with a single crown bleeding from her forehead, people come around from villages and miles around to just marvel at these individuals. So this isn't something that the living crucifix, as they've been called, this person bearing the marks of Christ, can very easily hide and conceal from the public. Right. They become major kind of displays. It's not their will. They're not running around bragging, oh, look at me, I'm like Jesus. They're quite the opposite.
If they are, then that would lead one to believe that they're not authentic.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. When Padre Pio was first struck with the markings in September 1918, he's there at Our Lady of Grace Chapel in San Giovanni Rotondo. He's praying for an end to World War I, which had raged for 4 years, right? Oh, Lord, please stop this war. Please stop this war. What could I do, Lord? What can I do to suffer? To join in your suffering, to unite in your suffering. What can I do to help expiate for the sins of the world for something like this? And you know, wham, he feels it in his hands, he feels it in his feet, and he's struck down and he's crying, no, Lord, no, don't do this. I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy. And he's all alone, he crawls back to his cell, you know, on his elbows, on his knees. He could never, throughout the rest of his life, walk in a normal way or even fully close his fingers. He goes into his room in his cell and he hides. Right. And the other brothers found out about it because there's a trail of blood going from the chapel to his cell, and they pound on the door. Francesco, right? That was his name, named after Francis. Francesco, let us in, let us in. No, no. And only under order of obedience by his superior does he allow him in, and then his superior looks and says, oh, Francesco, you know, what is this? What is this? He says, I don't know. You know, he's crying, I'm not worthy. Take him away. Take him away. They're not boasting. They're anything but prideful.
You also make the point in the book here, in the section Stigmatists Throughout History, you say the marks are wounds that are granted to the so-called victim soul as a special gift. It's actually a gift that is given. And it goes on, you quote somebody, stigmata is not given to the stigmatic for his or her benefit, but for the benefit of others. How so?
Yeah, they're really offering up their suffering to help expiate for the sins of the world. And also, too, Doug, in every case that I've seen, they suffer for a long time before they get the stigmata. They're already having visions of Jesus, of the Blessed Mother. They're in communication with the other world. Oftentimes, they see their guardian angel. They'll have these terrible sicknesses and physical traumas where their doctors and others think that they're going to die, but somehow make it through. Often they will be given hidden stigmata before they actually have real physical stigmata. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're prepped for this, right? Mm-hmm. They're being prepared to unite themselves with Christ in some sort of extra suffering. They're not given another spiritual gift, which might be evangelization, might be preaching. Mm-hmm. I had somebody say, Doug, you know, if I was going to get a special spiritual gift, I'd prefer something like maybe levitation, right?
There you go.
Or bilocation or something like that. But of all things, right? The stigmata.
Right.
But,
I was trying to remember whether you referenced the fact that there was some, was it Saint Rita, supposedly, who levitates inside her, where she's buried? I'm trying to remember which one of the stigma to say. I've got no way to prove it, but supposedly there's been some inference of that.
Right, yeah, a special odor. Her body was incorrupt for
right,
a long time.
So many of them that you bring up are incorrupt, right?
Yeah, and many of them have said Gemma Galgani, 1878 to 1903, Jesus told her, he said, my daughter, if you want to learn how to love, you must suffer, mm-hmm. right? It is through suffering that we really learn to love. When we give up our suffering, when we offer it up to others. And I remember when I first became Catholic or first came back into the church, hearing a group of older ladies at my church, and mm-hmm. one of them was suffering from something at that point, and one of the other ladies said, offer it up. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, Doug, I thought, offer it up? What does that mean?
Right.
And I asked them, and they said, well, offer up your suffering to be united to Jesus. You know, say to Jesus, this is horrible. I'm in pain. I'm in agony. This person in my life is dying, going through. This is terrible. Can I do something with this, Lord? Can you find a way to redeem this suffering? Can I some way and unite this to your passion? Mm-hmm. And my evangelical friends, a lot of them come from the sort of health and wealth gospel world.
Right.
And they will say to me, you know, you Catholics, you got Jesus on your cross, mm-hmm. on the cross in your churches. Yeah, but the cross is empty, brother. He is risen, right? He is risen. We know that. We know that he's risen. But when we walk into our churches on Sunday morning or any morning for Mass, and we're suffering, and we look up at that corpus, that bleeding body of Christ, and we think, wow, yeah, that was done to the Son of God. You know, look how he suffered. And what did he say? If you want to follow me, mm-hmm. right, don't get a real nice pension and retire early and get a vacation and have a whole bunch of money and a bunch of good food. Pick up your cross and follow me.
Right.
What would Jesus do? WWJD? Jesus would suffer, and he would call on us to do the same. And I think especially remarkable, so many of the stigmatists, everyone thinks they're bleeding in the hands, which they are. They're bleeding in the feet, maybe the crown of thorns, mm-hmm. maybe the side. Many of them said the most vexing wound that they have is the shoulder wound.
Right.
The shoulder wound from where Jesus carried the cross. And theologically speaking, when you think that Jesus tells us all as Christians, if we want to be Christians and follow him, carry the cross, mm-hmm. the fact that that would be a special, particularly vexing wound of these stigmatists, I think is theologically and spiritually pretty profound.
Right. Actually, it was something that Mother Angelica talked about. That's exactly the wound that she also talked about. One of the things you touch on here, physicality, hands versus wrists. We've heard that discussion about the fact, well, the Romans did it in the wrists, otherwise the hand would pull away, and you've got these stigmatists like Padre Pio, they're in the palm. And so maybe this is a psychological thing. Obviously, you talk about here as well, this idea, and one could even make a case that, you know, culturally, a lot of Italians, culturally, you're also dealing with a lot of women, and you know, people would say, well, they're more emotional, they're more sensitive, so these things are, even hypnotism is thrown around in here.
Right, yeah. In fact, one of the phrases was auto-suggestion that was suggested to Padre Pio, and he said, auto-suggestion, huh? Well, you tell that guy to imagine that he's a bull, and let's see if he sprouts horns from his head, okay? Mm-hmm. Auto-suggestion, right? I mean, talk about a leap of faith. I mean, how do you do that for 50 years? Auto-suggest yourself bleeding a cup of blood a day out of your hands? But there's debate about that, about whether or not Jesus was crucified through the palms or through the wrists. Mm-hmm. And to me, this would suggest that it was through the palms, mm-hmm. because that's where I haven't found a single one. Right. Who's bleeding through the wrists. And by the way, if you want scriptural.
Right, that was the thing that struck me when you pointed out Thomas and what our Lord said, right? Exactly.
Yeah, Thomas said, unless I can stick my fingers in the palms of his hands, right?
Right.
And Jesus says, come, put your fingers in my hands. He doesn't say, put them through my wrists. And by the way, just try to picture Thomas sticking his fingers through the bony wrists. Mm-hmm. Of Christ's wrists. How would you even do that? And my good friend Robert Orlando, who's done the documentary The Shroud of Turin,
sure.
He's actually on campus with me at Grove City College right now. And he says, well, if you look at the shroud, it looks like he's bleeding from his wrists. But it could also be that, you know, the blood from the hands goes down to the wrists and mm-hmm. leaves blood marks on the shroud by the wrists. Some have also said, I've heard one of your discussions with Father Spitzer.
Right.
That it could have, I think Father Spitzer says, the nails could have gone through the palm and down through the back of the wrist.
Wrist, right.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
That could be too. Although Padre Pio and some of the others, including Francis, you could see actual, in some cases, nail protrusions in their hand. And in Pio's case, they said, these were holes. You could look at his wrists, the bloody, or his hands, the bloody palms, and you could see all the way through the end. So it seems to be, seems to have been through the palms.
Right. Okay. You say here, as we shall see in this book, many of these stigmatists endured terrible suffering, not only from their wounds provided by the Lord, but from notably unsaintly men and women, not only lay people and scientists, but priests and nuns and even bishops of the higher rank, who treated them with suspicion and contempt, and who were often filled with jealousy, envy, and a lack of charity, a vice rather than a virtue. And we've seen that too. Obviously, Padre Pio was persecuted. We know about that.
Yeah, that was the worst case, probably. And he even said that he had more pain from the doubting clergy, the people that attacked him. You know, early on, after he's had the stigmata at this point for almost 3 years, the Vatican sent Padre Gemelli, who was a physician, a psychologist from a prominent family in Milan. And he went in and he visited Pio with all these preconceived prejudices. And Pio, of course, could read people's hearts. Mm. So he knew the moment that he saw Gemelli what Gemelli was thinking. Mm. And Gemelli really went after him in a really awful, unkind, uncharitable, terrible way. And Gemelli, who had an incredibly inflated pride, I mean, you should read some of Gemelli's accounts. He said, I've figured it out. Mm. I know what this is. Pio and his superior, Padre Benedetto, have an incubus-succubus relationship going on here, right? So it's kind of like crackpot psychology of the day, weird Freudian stuff,
right.
Accusing him of faking the wounds. I'll be back to see you, Pio. I'll be back to see you. Spent mere minutes with him. The Vatican, to their great credit, they sent back Monsignor Rossi, who later became Cardinal Rossi, who spent days at San Giovanni Rotondo, who spent hours with Padre Pio, looking at his hands, turning them up and down, touching the wounds, talking to him, investigating him. And the Vatican held that report secret for a long, long time. It was published by Ignatius Press just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But Rossi and others and a number of Cardinal Siri and a bunch of popes, they all believed that Pio was completely legitimate, and proof of that today would be that he was ultimately canonized by Pope John Paul II.
Absolutely. You have in here, there's so much in here, common sufferings and training, a period of trial. In Edia, I guess, is the scientific term applied to persons living by eating little or almost nothing, lack of sleep, death at the age of 33. And you talk about the hidden stigmata. Just before we go, I wanted to have this really interesting connection. I kind of vaguely heard something about Blessed Lucy of Narni, which was Narnia back at the time, and its connection to C.S. Lewis, which a lot of people might find interesting.
Yeah, I drove right through that town when I was in Italy in 2013, and my guide, my friend Fabrizio, said, Paul, this is where C.S. Lewis got the idea for Narnia. I'm like, yeah, right, Fabrizio, right? But it's true. That Lucy of Narnia, the Lucy character, that's Blessed Lucy of Narnia in Italy, Narnia, and she was a stigmatist. And among the traits you noted, I got to note, I know we don't have much time left, but spiritual anedia. Anne Catherine Emmerich lived on nothing but the Eucharist for the last 10 years of her life. Therese Newman lived on nothing but the Eucharist for 40 years. All right. And she went from about 120 pounds to about 210 pounds by the time of her death. And picture these German doctors, really precise, kind of rigid, you know, agnostic, atheistic scientists. And they're like, I can't explain it. She drinks only water. She eats only what they call the Eucharist. We try to give her any food, she vomits it up. And like clockwork, Thursday, Friday, she starts bleeding, stops on Saturday, the wounds disappear without a trace. There's no biological or medical explanation for this. How can this be? But they lived on nothing but their daily bread for decades. It's just physically impossible.
So when you're dealing with this, and you talk about the idea that there's some attraction, even for Protestants looking into this, I think there's a lot of attraction because people are dealing with such a materialistic world. They're really looking for what's beyond. They know something's beyond, and they want to connect to that. What do you say to people? They say, oh, those Catholics, again, they're always into these kind of masochistic things going on. You know, look at these poor people suffering. You know, they've got God, you know, giving them a hard time. And then instead of praying for healing, they just wallow in their suffering.
Yeah, I say open your mind. In fact, if St. Paul was one of the first stigmatists, then there's biblical precedent for it, right? So if you want to go to the Bible for this and read about these accounts, because I think these are people, you know, one can legitimately ask, well, you know, why has God waited? Why did God wait 1,000 years after the death of Christ, 1,100 years for someone like Francis? Why are there more now than before? Well, maybe in our day and age, being two millennia removed from the time of the apostles and Christ, you know, we need visual evidence of the supernatural to help us with our belief in this really secular, skeptical world. And things like this can really help us with the faith because we are doubting Thomas's, right?
Absolutely.
And they had things to tell us as well. And that's a big part of why I did this book.
Right.
Read about the prophetic warnings and the statements. There's some stuff there that's quite remarkable that we should pay attention to.
It's packed with information. A lot of it, basically, none of us would probably be aware of if you hadn't done the research, put it all together. Paul Kengor, thank you so much. The Stigmatists, their gifts, their revelations, their warnings, published by TAN, available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com. For all things Catholic, I highly recommend this book. It's very, very interesting, and it'll make you think if you're not thinking already. I'm Doug Keck. Join us next time right here on Bookmark.